This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes, between the lines, and sometimes outside of the art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Hello and welcome to the show. It's episode 248 with Cassie Thornton. She is, for now, a Thunder Bay, Ontario-based artist, specializing, one could say, in socially engaged art, among other things. And if her name rings a bell, it shouldn't be surprising, because she happens to be the partner, or Max Haven, I should say, happens to be her partner. And yeah, we did talk about some of her work that was included in the book, but she is indeed very much her own person. And it's different talking with an artist than with a cultural critic slash philosopher slash theoretician. So a very different episode, and we're not going to be doing four episodes as far as I know, but maybe we will. Who knows? Depends on how. I'd actually like to have her on my other show. I'm going to put this out publicly, apparently, how I get by. But she is, you know, I don't know what my previous preconceptions about talking with a socially engaged artist were, but it was a lot of fun talking with this particular socially engaged artist. I don't think it's a universal thing by any stretch, and you will find it very fun to listen to a socially engaged artist, in this case, Cassie, talk. And if nothing else, she bleeped herself in deference to my banning of the P word. So that in itself is priceless. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see the episode index going back, you know, all 247 prior episodes. You can find images and a video, which we talk about quite a bit towards the latter part of our conversation, that Cassie did, that I highly recommend. Once you get to that point in the conversation, if you haven't already, go to the website and take a gander at this particular video. It's not like nothing you've ever seen, for sure. It's called I Trusted You, I Trusted You, I Trusted You. There might be a fourth one, I'm not sure. But go check those out. You can, of course, also support the show, find our social media handles, and you can contact us there. What else do you need to know? We talk about her various projects, including Give Me Cred, which is the one that Max wrote about in his book, which I still think is just a phenomenal and impactful piece. So we get her take on it, how it came to be. We also talk about a much more recent piece, Desperate Holdings, in which she did a pop-up real estate agency in Oakland, California, and it turned into a real social experiment and experience, among many other things as well. And as I will tell you more about on the back end, we also had a whole separate conversation where she helped me think through some art ideas and even potential socially engaged variations of my own work. I will tell you more about that on the back end, and we, of course, have some classic old news, a.k.a. Weiss Links, as well. I think you're in for a great guest, one of my favorites of all time. Stick around on the back end for so much more. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. If you could just briefly just trace your trajectory from rural Illinois to where you are now, that would be great.
What a good question. Sure, yeah. So I started out in kind of rural northern Illinois, like within 2 hours of Chicago usually. But me and my mom would move basically every year. So I've lived in like every single little suburb of northern Illinois. And then eventually I went to college at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And I was the first person in my family to go to college. So it was a thing. Mm-hmm. And made a bunch of kind of goofy decisions about that, which become relevant later, by like taking, like really going to a very expensive school without really knowing why. But anyway, did that.
Wait, which one are you referring to?
Well, going to the University of Wisconsin-Madison as an out-of-state student, I think even in the early 2000s was like, you know, $20,000+ a year for tuition, which at that point was really, really remarkable.
Yeah. And what was your financial aid situation, if any?
I had worked as a waitress at Dog and Suds, which is like a drive-in 1950s restaurant. And so I had saved a pretty remarkable amount of money, like almost $10,000. And I had also started my own business in high school with my dad. We would detail cars, like paint flames on cars. And I mean, it was not a lot of business, but like the business we did a handful of cars. We made a bit of money and did it with spray paint, but they were really pro jobs. So I worked a lot, and then my family, I had like a kind of adopted step family situation. They threw in some money, and then I just took on like mega loans, and never looked back.
So hence the seed has been planted for your career with credit and debt. Right.
For sure. Right. I mean, I think that the seed was planted when I was very young, actually, because I found these drawings I was making where I was like drawing pictures of like superheroes that were like coming and like saving us from our credit cards. Because I think we were getting credit card collection calls when I was younger. It was like me and my mom were. So I think from a very young age, I was really, really interested in debt. And I think, you know, even like right at the beginning of college, I had made this giant painting of a debt mountain. So like, it was really something that was like there for a long time.
Wow.
Kind of mysteriously.
Can you then, back to your trajectory, take us to the point where you went out to California? What was was that straight from Madison, or was there some period between?
Yeah, there was an interlude. While I was in Madison, I studied abroad in London, and I got the sense that actually maybe I wanted to live in big cities. I went to the school Central St. Martin's for a year and realized that, you know, that I was into cities. And so then the moment I graduated college in 2004, I pretty much like packed up my stuff in some boxes and shipped them to New York and went to New York, and I moved to Bushwick and lived in what became kind of like dorms for art students or people who had just finished art school, and in this very sort of like at the cutting edge of gentrification in New York, where you had like housing projects right next to these big industrial buildings that were flipped so they could charge a lot of rent from art students. So I moved to New York and stayed there from about 2004 until 2010, and had all kinds of different, very interesting experiences there, including, I would say, the main two things were like living in very specific and strange legal and illegal places, and then the second thing is that I worked for a bunch of different art education nonprofit organizations. So I was doing like art education in after-school programs at New York City public schools, and I think I went into like something between like 40 and 50 public schools to teach art, which was very, very interesting, and I think so much of a reason why I stayed an artist and became the kind of artist I am. And then I moved to San Francisco in 2010, at the end of 2010, to go to grad school at California College of the Arts in the social practice program.
Right. And what was the situation there as far as speaking of, you know, high tuition?
Well, it was definitely like a very expensive situation at California College of the Arts. So like after I got accepted, I applied to go to grad school like maybe 3 or 4 months after the deadline. I put my application together overnight, like a fever dream. And this seems to be a sort of pattern in how I make decisions. I like don't know I'm going to make them until I make them, and then it becomes very real. So I applied, and my heart became very set on it in a very strange way. Only afterwards did I see how expensive it was going to be. And so after I got accepted, which I felt was like a miracle because I had never really been accepted to anything in my life or had tried something like this, I was very surprised that I got accepted. And so I got flown to come to like a kind of welcome, like introduction meetup with all the students that had been accepted to the social practice program. And I remember we're all sitting together, the person that was like the sort of the person in charge of and who had kind of invented social practice as a word and as a thing that you would have inside of an academy was Ted Purvis. And he was the main administrator for our program. He brought us all out to breakfast and we're all sitting around and there's like 13 of us and we're all dirty, scummy. Like we're kind of clearly like dorky activist-y people who like, you know, kind of got scraped from different parts of the world. We're all there together. It's feeling pretty awkward. And I was super concerned right then that like the money was going to be too much, but not just for me, for everybody. And so when Ted, the administrator, went to the bathroom, I said to everybody, guys, I just want you to think about this. If we all refused to pay our tuition, what would happen? They would have to let us come for free because who else, like not that many people know about this program and they've already gotten us all like signed up and involved. Like if we just decide not to pay, what would happen? And then Ted comes back from breakfast or from the bathroom and sits down and we all pretend like nothing happened. And like, anyway, I think from the very beginning, the tuition thing was like a very big psychic barrier for me because I was worried that not only would I be super stressed out about it, so would everybody else. Mm-hmm. And it would mean that we were going to be much more conservative in our decisions about what we're going to do, like what we're going to think about and what we're going to work on when we're in grad school. So, yeah.
So what ended up happening as far as any conversation or plan of action, you know, towards either that leader or the school in general? And maybe I should preface that question also by asking, to what extent was there maybe any flexibility considering A, that as you mentioned, you know, it was a newish program or new program, and so they were kind of happy to have people that they did, especially reflected in the fact that you had applied a few months late and got in after the deadline? Right.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think that what ended up happening is unfortunately what always happens when we're dealing with money and groups of people who are with a kind of like mysterious hierarchical relationship to an institution or organization. Like basically what happens is that everyone is like, so, especially among artists, I think, so hyper-individualized that everyone is pretty much already decided that the only person they can help is themselves. And also, they don't really, like, trust that they could, like, sort of attempt to change something or to, like, make a big demand as a part of a group of people because most people have never had that experience before. So what ends up happening is that everybody, I think, did sort of feel pretty burdened by the amount of money, which was $38,850 per year in a very expensive city.
Two-year program?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you end up with $100,000 at least of debt because you have to take out money or figure out how to like pay for your life in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I think everyone felt really, really burdened and overwhelmed by that. But like how we ended up dealing with that is that everybody goes by themselves to Ted, the administrator, to the student loan office or to the administration and says like, you know, I can't pay for this. Like I need I need help in some way, or I need you to lower the tuition, or I need an extra loan, instead of everybody going together and saying like, actually, like, this is insane. Like, you don't even pay, you know, you don't pay your administrators or teachers very well. And, like, we refuse to pay this amount of money because it is politically and financially, like, just stupid and impossible. Like, it became a very atomized thing. So we all, in the end, I think, went to Ted or went to the administration and made our own personal request for some sort of extra help. And so like I'm sure other people did this also because, I did hear stories in the end, but I would go, I went to Ted and I said, you know, I can't go unless there's some sort of subsidy. And so he created a little grant for me that I think he basically made up.
Wow.
In order to cut a little bit of my tuition. But So
it got trimmed down, but it wasn't anything hugely substantial, it sounds like.
No, I don't even remember what it was in a way. Like, I think it was just so, like, symbolic and not, like, maybe it was $5,000 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, if I could just jump in for real quick, one of the things that occurs to me as you're describing that arc of a conversation or a situation as far as you and your colleagues and you, you know, what you said to your fellow students and that what you said to him and suggested your fellow students say to him was it sounds, my takeaway is kind of that you were already a socially engaged artist kind of from the get-go. Like you were ready to hit the ground running. And yeah, does that kind of ring accurate?
For sure. I was very busy among a bunch of, I think, social practice artists that are in New York who were really thinking about education and justice for a long time. So I had lived with a bunch of people that might be familiar to people who are listening, like Caroline Woolard and Christopher Kennedy and Hong No, these people who I think are such amazing forward-thinking social practice artists, or if that's how they identify, but at that time
maybe we can call them socially engaged artists since the P word has already been used about five times.
Oh, right. I forgot that. Yep, no problem. Socially engaged.
exactly. I don't want to, you know, harp on this too much, but you did actually mention your teacher being the instigator or the dubber of this term. Is that basically what I heard?
Yeah.
Let's just talk about it for a minute. I mean, if it gets, you know, redundant or, you know, lame in any other way, we'll abandon it quickly. But why is it a social practice? What, you know, so every day you're waking up, it's like your yoga practice, you get up and you socially engage with your community. Is that basically the short version of it? How would you put it?
I would say, I think that it is a term that has existed and been used before in like sociology and anthropology to describe one's sleep. The way that people it's a word that describes the way that people do things that are not necessarily like working or relating to their family. It's like the bleeps that one does that describes something about their culture. So I think that, I mean, the term has existed and will exist outside of art. And I think that's important to say. And I think that when Ted was taking it and applying it to us, he was trying to put together all of these different practices, whether it's like participatory art, interactive art, socially engaged art, relational aesthetics, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think he was trying to put it together to make a title for something which could become a part of the academy, which was about a rigorous social interaction that was a part and a process, or a product and a process within an art project. And I think the other part of it that is probably important to mention is that I think a main characteristic of this work is that it can exist in a gallery, but it doesn't have to. And it can have a kind of product, like a material manifestation that comes out of the whole process, but it doesn't have to. That, like, actually a kind of the social part of it is enough. And so, yeah, I would say that that's kind of what characterizes it. And then, like, some of the patterns that you see, like, especially coming from that program, which was the first social bleep program, mm-hmm. was many obviously came to follow. I believe this one began in 2004 or something like that. Is it like you have artists that are working heavily with like research, and some of that research is social, and then that there's a kind of, there's an overlap often with an activist aesthetic or bleep, and those things kind of come together to form something that now has cohered to become, you know, that, that like actually has an aesthetic and a sort of a very, a pretty solid sensibility. Like you can kind of, it's now something that has cohered. It's really hard not to use this word that you don't like.
Well, let me ask you this. First of all, I appreciate your bleeping 75% of the times that you said it since I mentioned it, because that's going to save me some editing time. But would you agree that the use of that word, as in social P word, you know, among other uses in contemporary art context, is largely about professionalism? And I'll just add that you mentioned its history in, or its precursor in anthropology and sociology. So that suggests an academic angle. So you've got the academic angle and or the professional angle, which is a form of legitimacy and you know, sort of academic validation.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, I do think that's a big part of the decision to use that word for TED.
Yeah.
Because it did give it some legitimacy for sure.
Right. So that's the thing. It's like it's the academy has so much invest stock in that word that when the art world or when contemporary art or what have you, modern art, appropriated it itself, it was sort of doing the same. It's like, this means business, you know? We're not fucking around here. This is a P word.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And I think that like the way that these programs developed, and I have not been paying attention to what new programs have developed or how they've developed. I've been sort of off of that radar for a few years, but the way that they were developing when I was paying attention was that like so many institutions were finding that if they started a socially engaged art program, no matter what they called it, art and activism, participatory art, blah, 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 they basically had like such a good money-making scheme on their hands, because with this type of artwork, you can say, well, we don't give you studios, we don't give you classes, we are just going to ask our faculty who are already working here if they would just add on a new course, and we can call it a new program. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe something has happened, like there's been a bit more ingenuity and energy that's gone into it since like we have so many different kinds of like larger institutions supporting it, and it's included inside of museums and stuff now. But like at the early stages, it was pretty funny. It was like quite transparent that institutions like were kind of up for a cheap way to get some new students.
I think I'm trying to put, among other things, trying to put my finger on or hone in on the fact that you do have such a unusual origin story that has had an impact on your, you know, emphasis or your drive towards this thinking outside the box. The negotiations that you were doing,
right,
you know, with your family was a really good proving ground for what was to come.
I think the other thing that is sort of interesting that doesn't come up very much in like my life or conversations is that like a big part of my desire to look at debt, once I kind of realized that I was in grad school and like we're definitely making more debt than we're making art, I really was like, why am I so attracted to debt? Why is this? And it took like 5 minutes to realize that my mother had been sort of at the cutting edge of like the sort of financial crash. Like we had had our house was foreclosed, like we'd had many bankruptcies, like she had worked in retail jobs, including like Walmart. Like I had seen the financial system from the other side, from like the downside, so much in my mom and my life. And so I think a lot of what I was doing as I was trying to understand like debt when I was in grad school was also trying to understand debt and the economy as a system that would mean that like if the system is predatory and kind of like built to ruin, then a lot of the things that have happened in my life wouldn't be like my fault or wouldn't be my mother's fault. And so I think like that's the other side of like the kind of relationship between the work in grad school and like childhood, that I think it's like, you know, you can have so much energy to pursue something like in a sort of conceptual way or a theoretical way. But then I think when, for me, having the chance to also explore something that was so part of my childhood, but like in a kind of secret way, was like so, so useful and productive.
Yeah. So you did this piece, Give Me Cred, which Max Haven and I talked about, but you know, I want to hear more about it from your perspective. What was the thinking process or the working process that kind of finally led you to come to the answer, or you know, or the idea? Mm. You know what I mean? Was it kind of like
a
eureka moment type of thing, or did you sort of, you know, was it the gathering of so many ideas and experiences over time that sort of organically just led you there?
Huh. Well, I mean, it kind of grew, the idea grew on me kind of like hair on my head or something. Like it felt almost inevitable. Like basically, I have been working with a couple of different organizations, but mostly with Strike Debt, first in New York and then in San Francisco, we started one, or the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And so Strike Debt is like a group that is about sort of creating public pedagogy around like what debt is and how it affects our lives, and then also trying to organize people to sort of fight against it in different ways. But in that process, especially when I was, I think, in the Bay Area, I felt that like we were limited by our inability to actually confront our own economic instabilities, and that like in some way, there were ways that we were being made to be obedient to systems that we were saying we were fighting against, but we couldn't take that many risks because, we couldn't take that many personal financial risks because we were all so obedient to, like, the credit reporting system. So just for example, like, me and a couple of other people as a kind of experiment, but also because I think we were all, like, not doing great financially, we're like, well, we're going to stop paying a credit card. We're going to all do it together. We're going to see what happens. Mm-hmm. We know the rules, but just because things are like organized around legal frameworks, that doesn't mean that that's what corporations are going to actually do. Let's all not pay and see what happens. But then it turned out that it was only me and one other person because everybody else was afraid to do it. And that makes sense because if you don't pay your debt, like a credit card, the credit card reports it to Equifax or whatever, and then that goes on your credit score. And then the next time you get in line to get an apartment or even a job in most states, the people in power, the employer or the landlord, can then decide you're not trustworthy enough to give you the thing that you need, the job or the apartment. So like it totally makes sense that we're living in fear and very obedient to the credit reporting system. But it just seems... it seems so rote and so, it seems like something that should be a government-run thing, but actually it's private. And so I guess I just felt like, well, if it's like a private company running this, and really like the Financial Reserve, like no part of the federal government has any oversight over it, like why don't I see what it would be like to just make like a more humane version? And if I think, you know, it was really so much about trying to create the possibility for more people to be more radical with their money, like so that they would stop paying their debts and not have to live in fear. So it took a long time to get the guts to do it. I think I talked about it an extreme amount. I did like many, many years of very strange research, and there were lots of like startups already kind of working on redesigning credit reporting, I think, with the knowledge that the internet was going to be a kind of gateway to like sharing information and gathering way more information about individuals. And then also China had already began to experiment with like Sesame Credit, making kind of like credit reporting into something where that included like who you're dating and all this stuff. So anyway, I was like, I felt like I was just working kind of in the spirit of all these different people that are all trying to work on like innovations to the credit report. But I wanted to do it from like a much more radical point of view that said that like most people deserve, I mean, everybody deserves a home and a job or whatever they need to survive, but most people deserve a medal just for surviving the financial system that actually wants to eat them alive. And so if we could find a way to tell people's amazing stories of like actually how they made it, like why they're trustworthy for having survived all of the sort of challenges in their lives, that maybe we would create a potential moment when a landlord or other stakeholder or employer would be able to see people as like people and not as financial beings.
Was it implicit that you made it kind of sound like a number of participants or people who received these alternative credit reports you created went into debt, in some cases even purposely, like you described, so that they could then, you know, have it not be a factor in their getting an apartment or a job? To what extent was that the case?
I mean, the most people went into debt or fell kind of like into a zone of like unpayable debt, like by and large by having a medical emergency or a death in their family. Like that was really the story that I was telling, is that like most people that I met like basically had a kind of unforeseen thing happen in their lives that meant that was completely out of their control. But then everything after that was about like trying to prove that they were, though they had survived this thing, they were still worthy of getting a apartment and a job. And so that was really the story that most of them told. It was pretty sad because really, I mean, it just shows that like, the medical system is like really sucks, and it makes it so that if you do have an injury, it means that it could set you back in such a way that like you actually for like many, many years to follow can't catch up, whether it's because you couldn't work for some time or because you did have a big medical debt or because you're disabled and you couldn't afford the care you needed or whatever. And so, I mean, I think that the important part about the project is that like most of us who go through stuff like that, like, which is most people in the U.S. who aren't so super wealthy, like, most of us have never been asked to, like, tell that story. And basically, what my work was to sit down and say, okay, Michael, like, tell me the story about how, you know, your beloved aunt died, you went into a deep depression, and then you couldn't go to work for 3 months, which meant that you lost your job, couldn't pay your loans, and then had your, like, lost your apartment, and then ended up homeless. Like, and so then by repeating it back to them, but by including the sort of social conditions that led to this apocalyptic situation, it kind of helps people to sort of see their own stories as stories not of like personal failure, but of actually like wow, I can't believe I survived this situation, which was so not caring, like so not supportive, and maybe even like extremely, extremely predatory and built to hurt me. And so I think like what really ended up happening is that I would sit down with people. They would bring their credit report and their traditional credit report and their resume. I'd ask them a bunch of questions just by basic observation. I would get their story, share it back to them, and then we would write the credit report together. And then whether they use the credit report or not, they would go to their next meeting with a landlord or job interview, and they would fucking get it. And I swear, it was like half the time they actually brought the thing. Half the time they didn't even bring the document that I made for them because – and it works because they actually believed that they deserved the shit instead of feeling like poor, horrible losers and like, you know, like failures who didn't deserve a house or a job. And I don't think it ever didn't work.
It was self-prophesizing and rewriting the story for them.
Totally.
Yeah. And it sounds like a huge number, like a majority of these stories were there was either a death and or a medical emergency that sort of started the deep slide.
Yep, totally.
Yeah. And when you are you still doing it to any extent?
I would love to do it. I just haven't been since I haven't been living in a big city, it's not been something that I've thought about doing, but I would absolutely do it. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it's awesome. When you did do it, to what extent? I mean, I think you already answered the question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because you did describe that half the, you know, many times people would go to these interviews and they got the thing and they didn't have it with them. But that said, was there any, as part of this, the creation of these alternative credit scores, did you feel like you needed to set up a business entity, an LLC or what have you, you know, that was part of it? Or was it more like just, you know, your company name or what have you?
I seriously tried to figure out how to make it into a larger business or like a business. Yeah. Like I wanted it to grow and become like viral.
Yeah.
Only use like my website and like my, I posted in libraries and, grocery stores and put the ads on Craigslist. And yeah, I think that's basically how I found people that to do it. And I just said, you know, do you have bad credit? And would you be willing to participate in an artistic experimental process to give you an auxiliary credit report? Like, hey, it can't hurt. And, you know, 100% of our trials so far have worked and people have gotten the thing they needed, even, you know, impossible things pretty soon after we did the process. So I basically, that's how I got it around. And then I had this big wish to, I had a show at Southern Exposure in San Francisco in the Mission where I was focusing on the credit reporting as a project. I had built a huge table and put my office underneath that, so it was like working under the table. And I was, for that show, done 20 credit reports. And the idea was that I was going to do these credit reports, but then do a training for the people who received the credit reports from me so they could do it for someone else. And
right.
So the hope was that it was going to go viral
right. And
that like a bunch of people would be able to start doing it for each other. But like, the reality is that like the people that I did it for were like struggling broke people who were like, oh my God, I'm going to survive. Like I got the apartment after looking for 2 years and they did not feel like, you know, joining my participatory art project to help other people. They were like, yes, I'm going to make it. So that project did not go viral at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really, as you've been talking more about the finer points, I've been thinking that is a real shame, you know, that this isn't a much wider spread project/phenomenon. And I wonder, I'm thinking as you're talking about it, does it feel like, you know, we've talked about pushing up against, you know, the box or whatever metaphor you want to use, did it ever feel like I really want to push up against the system in terms of viralness or, you know, promotion and sort of see if I can come at it in a different way just so I can get this fucking thing, you know, outside of its limited context?
Yeah. This is something is such a big question for me. When I've lived in New York or San Francisco with some of my projects, I would do kind of very strange outreach and find like the other people doing the non-art version of whatever I was doing. And I've always had this kind of fantasy of like working together with like real world people who are like capable of actually doing business and growing things and like seeing where a project like Give Me Cred would go. But there's something in me that always ruined it. there's something in me that I think is like really grossed out by the reality of how like business works. And I wish that I could kind of wholeheartedly like grow something like Give Me Cred I think if I really like, the kind of project that I could have like spent 5 or 10 years just working on that and just focused on it. But there's something in me that has never allowed me to do that. I don't really know what it is. And I don't know if that's something that's like a problem or if it's like, or a problem, not a problem, but like if that's a negative thing or if this is just like my job is to kind of have a ton of ideas about how we could do things and try them all out like a machine gun style, like one after the other, and then sort of see what sticks and watch it travel.
Yeah,
I think that's been my system is like steal my ideas, please, because I don't have the kind of like brain or the kind of like attention span to really stay with something and make it grow.
You just quoted something that I was going to ask you about, which is, so your, I don't know, pseudonym, your business, your art entity is the Feminist Economics Department at feministeconomicsdepartment.com. Mm-hmm. And then if you scroll all the way down to the bottom, it says, if you steal any of my work, please tell me how it goes. So I was going to, which I thought was hilarious the first couple of times I read it. And so I think you just answered my question. So what was that about? It's about just fucking take this and run with it because, you know, I'm on to the next project. I need more hands on deck.
I like really want to push up against the idea that as artists or creative people that we're like in competition with each other. And like when I really love helping other people with their projects. It's like something I spend a lot of time and energy on. I love to listen to people talk about their projects and I love to like support people as they like figure out how to be like the best version of whatever they are. And I feel like there's this awkwardness, like nobody wants to take too much from someone else because we're taught to be competitive. And I'm just like, actually, what if we're not competitive? What if we just see the project of like world fixing as a collective project and we throw all of our stuff in the center, all of our skills, all of our ideas, and just like hopefully something in there works. So I really am honest about the steal my shit thing. And I think it's happened too. I think that people have borrowed and like I think it's been good.
You know, I was so happy to hear you just a moment ago talk about how you spend this time helping people with their ideas and you really enjoy that process, because I think I have something to run by you, which we can maybe save towards the end of the conversation, and maybe you can give me your two cents. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the decision making that led you to move to Thunder Bay, as far as the pros and cons, and I mean, to what extent, just to maybe cut to the chase, if you will, to what extent was it about having job security?
Hmm. Well, I mean, so like Max Haven is my partner and I was living in Oakland, up until like 2017, but, basically he got this position, which is, really special and not like anything that exists in the U.S. education system, but it's in Canada, it's called the Canada Research Chair, and basically it means that a person is supported to do their own intellectual work for like up to 10 years with funding and with very little teaching, but you have to kind of go where you're sent. And so I was really priced out of Oakland and not really sure what I was going to do next in terms of money and housing. And he got this job, and so we were sort of like, well, maybe we should just try moving to the city. And I read the news about the city and I read things like, this is the racism murder capital of Canada.
Yeah.
And then I don't know Canada. I hadn't known Canada. In the US, we don't think about Canada very much.
No.
And there's not a lot of access to like Canadian media or anything. So like, I really didn't know any of the sort of like deeper underbelly of like Canadian culture or Canadian history. So I just was sort of thinking like, sure, like this will be interesting. We'll go to this sort of rural place and, you know, we will had this interesting life where we could actually like work as activists in a city that needs it. And, you know, maybe if we move to a small city like this, like we'll be able to do stuff that really matters and really, and that is actually very helpful and not just symbolic the way that a lot of stuff felt in Oakland or New York. Symbolic being like, you know, we're gonna like stage a giant like protest or like a die-in or even like the credit reporting, like we're gonna do stuff that's very beautiful that represents our feelings and what we want, but we're never gonna actually be able to sort of see the fruits of that labor in terms of like actual societal change. I think very naively that coming to a smaller city, we would be able to work in a very direct way and like see kind of change happen based on our work. And I think that is still not completely impossible, but I think that the reality of moving anywhere is that it takes a really long time to get to know a place. And mm-hmm. when you're dealing with something like racism, and specifically the kind of very deep, old, embedded racism against Indigenous people in Canada, that shit is buried so far inside of people's psyches and inside of people's lives that, you know, there's no quick changes mm-hmm. to be made. Everything takes a very long time. So anyway, that was a big part of why I wanted to come. Also, housing. Like, the idea that we could move somewhere where we could afford to live without having like every single purchase or every month be a question of whether we are going to make it or not, which was definitely what colored my life in Oakland and New York, a kind of constant hustle.
Sure.
So it has been really interesting to have, we've bought a house, we have stable housing, we have roommates, we have like a dog and a cat living in our house and plants, things that I couldn't have really imagined having in any of the cities that I've lived in before. So I'm just getting, it's really just this sort of experiment on me. What is it like? Like, what does it do if you're not just working to survive all the time? Like, what's left?
Right, yeah, that's great. That's great. Has he only been there the same amount of time you have, or was he there before that?
Yep.
Wow.
And we moved together.
Where was he coming from, though?
He came from Halifax. He was teaching
right.
at
That's
NASCAD.
What I thought. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. Right. So you were coming from Oakland. He was coming from Halifax. And so you bought this house together. And do you have roommates mm-hmm. because you for affordability or because you want to help them out or what?
We have roommates for a bunch of different reasons. I think that like for me, a very big reason is to not live as a couple in a house, in a kind of like domestic, like in a heteronormative, like super lockdown life in the burbs. I mean, so this means that we have like just other people and other like stuff going on in the house, which means like, I don't know, we're just much more sane.
Instant social life. You don't have to depend on leaving the house for a social life.
In the house.
Yeah.
Well, and just like that feeling of being kind of like living within a relationship, especially in a quiet place like this.
Right.
It just seems like very sane to do
right.
it. And then
right.
The other half is that we are like a big part of our decision to move here was that we could travel, which now understanding the climate emergency in the sort of shape and form that we now all see it, like it's a little bit different. But when we moved here, we were thinking, well, we'll spend half of our time in Thunder Bay and then half of the time we'll travel and do projects and get out of here. And maybe even like live and like have an address in a different city. Mm-hmm. And so that we can stay sane. And so having roommates means that we can afford to do that because then like when we're gone, it's not like we're just like paying the mortgage anyway. But now at least I think for me, it's very important to reduce the air miles. So, you know, maybe the roommates become less of an economic thing and more of a social asset.
Mm-hmm. So are you consciously doing more car trips maybe than plane trips for that thinking or not necessarily?
Maybe. I mean, I think like mostly I'm trying to just narrow things down to what I really want to do and where I really want to go. And like maybe taking, I mean, we were on the road like at least half or more of the year. I can't even imagine how many miles we flew in the last 3 years. But I definitely did, and Max did a little bit less, but I lived out of a suitcase really since 2016. So I think just focusing a little bit on like having a home as a center and then maybe taking like one or two trips, doing one or two big projects a year is just a big shift towards that.
Does that burn you out a little bit to all that traveling?
Yeah,
Yeah.
totally.
Yeah, I would think so. So I want to ask you about the Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland, desperate holdings, real estate agents, all of that maybe balled up together. And I just for with at the risk of being, not art focused enough because I'm such a maniac for housing, I do want to start with that. I do want to start with that line that you mentioned that, you got priced out of Oakland. You were living, from what I read on your site, one of your projects even, you were living in San Francisco at one point. Maybe that was when you were going to CCA. But just maybe either generally or specifically, you generally talked about the hustle and having to, obviously like I do and have for years, put way more than 50% of my earnings towards housing. Where did the line, where did the straw that broke the camel's back happen when it came to no longer being able to afford to stay there?
I think when, so I had this very like crazy time in my life where I did a bunch of projects right after grad school, and then I was doing a project in New York City, and I had a little bit of money left from the project. So that money was like either going to go towards rent and I would fly and a plane ticket, or I could bike home. So bike from New York to San Francisco. And I opted to find a cheap bike and bike home.
Are we talking
And I'm a
about a
big pet.
pedal bike or a motorbike?
A regular bike, like a bicycle with just
Right.
two wheels and some pedals.
So
Yeah.
you rode a bicycle cross
And
country?
yeah, and I've done a lot of big bike rides. I mean, I'm just a person that loves bikes, but not particularly like nice bikes or anything. I just really like riding bikes. And so I
Wow.
really just hacked together some stuff and biked home. And it took me a couple months in 2014. And then I got back and I had a residency at the Headlands. And I had like a couple, like maybe a year at that time of like really stable, good art gigs with like big institutions. And I had like plenty of funding and like definitely the most funding that I had ever had. And I just after the Headlands, I lost my apartment in San Francisco, which was very affordable.
What
And
happened?
so
What
I guess,
happened?
I mean, the, well, it was a funny thing, but I was trying to, it was a two bedroom apartment. I was going to be traveling. I was trying to sublet my part of the apartment or the entire part of the apartment with the help of my other roommate to this Mexican family. Because it was in the Mission, and it is like it was sort of a decision that was like kind of like we felt like gentrifiers in that neighborhood. And when someone had asked us if we could, if we had, knew of a place for this family, and we just thought like, well, we should try to make that happen. And as we were trying to make that happen, the landlord sort of like smelled something in our game. Like he sensed that something was up and that we were going to be subletting again, that I was going to be traveling. And he kind of told me that if I tried to sublet anymore, that he would take the lease away. And then I think I'm not exactly sure like what happened in what chronological order, but there was a certain point when it was clear that if we were going to stay, he was going to raise rent. And then, yeah, it was just a sort of like a bunch of different sort of confusing communications and a lot of like passive aggression. And I think me and my roommate were just like, we did, I think we just realized it was over. So when I left that place, I moved so many times before I was able to find a permanent place. I think I moved like 6 or 7 times. I lived on a boat. I lived in like a collective house. I lived in a little house by myself. I moved so many times, and all of it was just like, it all felt like very temporary and very unstable. And I don't know, I think that I just sort of like naturally reached a point where I was like working so much at so many jobs and just barely making it. And I was just feeling like so anxious all the time. It was a sort of like natural occurrence.
Yeah, you're reminding me, for what it's worth, on my other podcast, How I Get By, about how people get by financially. I did an episode with this guy named Antonio who told the story of going from living with his partner, in a like $4,000+ loft, in south of Market, to breaking up, losing that place. He was homeless for 6 months, and now he's sharing a 1-bedroom apartment with 2 other dudes in the Tenderloin. You know what I mean? And it's like,
holy shit.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, it's like it's either that or you've got plenty of cash.
Yep.
So on this same topic, Desperate Holdings, real estate agents, is this pop-up that you just wanted, I guess one of your more recent pieces, presumably. Mm-hmm. What do you want to say about that? I mean, it wasn't Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
What do you feel like your objective was, and to what extent, in retrospect, do you feel like you met those objectives or what have you?
So I think this project was like maybe one of the most complex, like layered projects I've ever done.
Mm.
And so it's like, just to say that it's like, it's very multivalent, and it's kind of hard to ever describe it in a way that like covers everything very quickly. But I think that the most basic thing I wanted was to have a space in downtown Oakland that made us question the very existence of like real estate as the main organizing system for cities. And I think it was entirely successful. I think it was actually like such a successful project for people who were just walking by, because it basically looked like a real estate agency. Like if you were walking by it, it was inside of this gallery called Dream Farm Commons. And Dream Farm Commons is inside of a storefront on a street in Oakland that's still got a lot of small businesses on it and all like locally owned. And so it has a storefront with 2 front doors, and basically it's like symmetrical. So on the right hand side was Desperate Holdings Real Estate with like, like a gold serif font in the window with like those, like a grid of plexiglass in the front window. So that it read like real estate, and to the point where people came in expecting it to be real estate. And then the other part of the front window, or the other half of the gallery, was occupied by Land Mind Spa, and those 2 businesses were just separated by a thin black curtain. But they looked from the outside to be 2 different businesses. But when you got in, it was very clear that like 2 roommates or 2 small businesses in any big city, like sometimes you have to kind of like make friends with strange bedfellows or something and like share tight space because of rent. But actually, these 2 things were 2 parts of the same project. And the idea of Desperate Holdings was to create a real estate agency from the future when we're no longer buying or selling land, and that instead we have real estate agents on hand who will help you transform your relationship to property, to land, and to belonging.
Mm.
And the way we would do that is by taking people over to the spa and getting them to get involved with one of our services, which all involves using this clay, that was dug up from underneath the financial district in San Francisco in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole project came to be because of this clay, which basically like they're digging to build the tallest skyscraper on the West Coast. for the Salesforce Tower. And so they're digging really, really deep down in the financial district. And I just asked, me and a friend asked if we could have some of whatever they were digging up. And it turned out that they were digging up this really beautiful clay. And I've been like super attached to the clay since I've had it. And I've never been able to figure out what to do with it because it felt so important. But I was always seeing it as like this sort of other type of real estate. Like it was like the only California real estate I would ever have, or like the last San Francisco real estate you can touch. And so I wanted to create this real estate agency, which would use the clay to transform our idea of like what land and real estate are. So it was like a weird, like you would pull back the curtain from, and then when you, like if you went into the real estate agency, you could pull back the curtain and it was like this sort of really messy spa / like laboratory with like clay everywhere, like all these kinds of like weird blobs, and like it was very, very dirty. And I think in some way, like the project was about giving people access to this clay and then like letting them make their own connections to like what it is to like have land or to have belonging mm-hmm. on land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was a very like contained, like it was like a, you know, the whole format was a pop-up that was open for months. We were open like during business hours, like very, you know, like I was there basically like all day, every day. And I was just there to kind of like talk to people and to think about this question of like, how else might we distribute land? And there were things like videos in the space. There was jewelry made out of the clay so people could walk away wearing a piece of real estate. And the whole thing was very, very messy. Like, not only was it dirty, but, like, it wasn't the kind of social P-word project that is, like a game or, like, very, like, clear. Like, oh, well, I go into the space. Like, you know, I get a portrait made of myself. It gets copied onto a mug, and then I leave. It was, like, very convoluted and confusing and messy and, like, very social. And yeah, and I think that that's what it needed to be, because I think that all of these issues around like belonging and home and real estate are like so, so confusing and convoluted, and that like it, the process of trying to even think that something else is possible is so messy and takes so much work. And so like this space was really there for that.
And what was the typical type of visitor that you would have, you know, who would come up to a serious looking, you know, real estate business and then maybe see ready for rematriation, one of your three, ads mm-hmm. and go in, you know, open to this bizarre kind of dialogue as opposed to seeing like, you know, an actual real estate, you know, house for sale and going in.
Well, there was one guy that was the dean of a high school that was on the corner, and he, I saw him looking at the signs and laughing.
Mm.
So I just like kind of waved through the window and he came in, and like we had a really intense conversation about it. Like he's from Oakland. He didn't know what Indigenous meant until recently. And he didn't know like what the name was of any of the Indigenous people that lived on the land before. And so we ended up having a really interesting conversation about how in high schools in Oakland, how history teachers and geography teachers are trying to incorporate stories and information and actual like visits from local Indigenous people from the Bay Area. So, you know, like I had visitors like that. And then I had tons of old folks come. There was like a low income old folks home at the end of the street, and they would just pour in every day. And like, I had the most interesting conversations about the history of Oakland. Most of the people I met were Black and like old residents of Oakland. And, you know, I ended up getting super involved with one woman named Miss V, who would come in, and she just loved the project so much. She would just come in and sit there for like hours and just watch as people came in. And she would talk to people. She brought her friends over. She would come to all of our events. And we had this amazing thing. I mean, we became friends, but we had this amazing experience where one day she didn't come in and I was worried about her. So I sent her a text message. She's 75 years old. And she called me back and said, the reason she didn't show up is that she was afraid to leave her house because her Social Security was garnished. And it was garnished because she had a student loan from 1973 of $333 for which the student loan, like whatever, the federal student loan company, garnished her Social Security. So she didn't have enough money for food. And so we ended up spending an enormous amount of time together working in the office on trying to figure out if that was going to happen again and how to fight the garnishment. So then she made me a homemade sign to put in the window that said that we also do like student loan consulting. So like it was like actually an actual community project. I mean, it never really, I didn't know that it would be, but it actually naturally became that. And the art world was not interested in it at all. Like there were very few like art people besides my friends that were really hanging out. It was really people on the street, like construction workers on their lunch break and real estate agents that stopped by because they were like, oh, maybe I should work here.
Right. To what extent does that bother you or not, the art world part?
Well, I expected to have a little bit more like interest, I guess. Mm-hmm. I guess I would have really liked to like have, well, I think I'm very surprised. I'm not living there, so I don't obviously like see what the exhibits are every week. But it doesn't feel like the housing crisis is really like being dealt with in the art world there. And like I know there's one artist that I might introduce you to that does work on it, and she works on it very directly as an activist and as an artist. Mm. But it feels like we're kind of isolated in dealing directly with the thing that hurts the most.
Yeah.
But I guess I just would have liked to like have more conversations or more interest. Because it feels like such an open wound there.
Yeah.
And of course, like, you know, I'm always like any publicity is good publicity because it just means that there's like going to be more people to talk to and more projects to do. But besides that, I never get very much interest from the art world. It's just like, I'm just kind of, I get a lot of attention from people in academia. And I think like, I have like a few, I have like followers who are kind of like otherworldly people who are just interested in interesting stuff. But the art world doesn't often kind of like bite into my stuff.
I'm trying to break you. I'm trying to break you and Max. And that's and that's the thing that runs through art after money too, is that, you know, I hadn't heard of any of you know, other than like people like Hans Hacke and Lee Lozano, you know, and Joseph Beuys, obviously, but I mean of these contemporary artists, I hadn't heard of any of them. It's because the market is just so dominant, you know, and that when you're working on projects, and Paolo Cirio talked about this to the extent that with his work, you know, museums largely didn't want to touch it because people on the board were connected to tech companies or oil companies, you know, or what have you. You know, so there was this sort of like, and for you, it's not that same thing, but it's a market factor. It's, you know, these are things that are so not saleable. And so, you know, why are we going to be interested? It's kind of like, I guess it's kind of like, I mean, with David Hammons, I don't know how much activism he's done, if any, but I don't think he's actually really done much at all that I can think of other than simply, you know, supporting his community and, you know, and his artist colleagues.
Right.
You know, it's really it's very difficult to think of an artist. I was trying to think of an example of an artist who either started off making, you know, community-based experimental work and then started making more marketable work and that eventually drew attention to the earlier work or vice versa. But I can't really think of anybody who's done that, you know, off the top of my head anyway. So.
Yeah, I can't either.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, maybe before we finally jump into this brainstorming session, I want to ask you, unless there's something you particularly would feel remiss if we didn't talk about, this one video of yours that I watched called I Trusted You, I Trusted You, I Trusted You, which is fantastic. And it features, for people who need enticement to go see it, it's a split screen with you on the left and a vintage video of Andy Kaufman doing this performance where he sings I Trusted You over and over again in front of an audience with various intonations and whatnot, which is pretty wild. But I guess if nothing else, the thing that I definitely wanted to ask you about is that you go into this very sincere crying bout at one point in the course of the video. And I guess I want to know how much sense memory you were using, you know, to what extent that was authentic. And if so, you know, what you used as your source of inspiration.
Well, so it's so funny that this is the thing that you end up asking about, because it actually was about, this was a part of Give Me Cred. I was doing a show in Cleveland, and I put an ad out saying that I wanted to find people and to do alternative credit reports. And one guy contacted me, and he was a comic book illustrator, and he was super interesting, but he was like losing his apartment and losing his job, and like there was just so much hard stuff happening in his life. But I ended up like spending a lot of time before I went to Cleveland, and then while I was there, on the phone with him, trying to help him figure out like how to kind of survive and end up getting to apply for some apartments and stuff like that. And I had promised him in the process that I would actually give him a part of my, if not all of my artist stipend for the show, to get him his apartment, or to get him a down payment on his apartment. And then I had already made a credit report for him and he was using it. And the work of kind of like trying to get him launched out of the really difficult series of situations he was in became my project. And I thought that was super interesting. Like, I'll make my whole project about a case study of one person, and in the meantime, lift him up and like get him settled. And like, you know, talk about making change with art. Let's just get right to the point. So when I first got to Cleveland, and I was gonna meet up with him for the first time, he had gotten really impatient with me and was kind of like, "Where's the money?" And right then, as I arrived in Cleveland, my dad had a heart attack, and I was like, "Buddy, like, I'm so sorry that I'm not gonna be able to get you this money like immediately, because I have to deal with like the most important thing, which is I got to get to Chicago like now, because I'm worried he's going to die." So he was super pushy with me on the phone, and really like, he really scared me. And it was sort of like one of those things where I'd become so kind of faithful to the idea of supporting this guy, and then he totally broke my trust.
Yeah.
And also broke my art project. So I was actually, I mean, all of the tears and the upset were so real, because I had such a big desire to actually just like to do this thing. And he just made it so I really didn't want to anymore.
Yeah. It sounds like he really shot himself in the foot in a big way. I mean, when you're helping somebody out, the last thing that you want is the opposite of appreciation and gratefulness.
Well, or like I'm even okay with that, because I feel like so many people have never gotten good support before, so how would they know how to receive it? Like, if you've never been cared for, like, it's not super easy to just like receive something good. And I really was trying to do this in a way that was like, all people deserve housing. Like, let's make this happen. It's not about you. This is about like humans, helping humans. And then when I became a human again, because I actually had needs in that my dad was sick and I needed to help him, that he couldn't see that was like very heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And so I'm so glad you liked that video. It's one of my favorite things I've ever made, and it's very rare that anybody ever even notices it.
Wow. Well, I want to ask you too, how did it feel maybe once you were editing, you know, and then subsequently releasing the piece, having that much of a vulnerability out there?
Well, we put it in the show that I had in Cleveland, and the curator was not particularly like excited and was very like cautious around it. And was, yeah, it was interesting. I didn't feel like she really like cared for it too much, and which made it more, I think, more vulnerable. And I don't think anybody really talked to me about it at that show. It's like one of those things that you put up and then and you're really nervous and excited about it. And then, you know, it just kind of goes flat a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I think generally in the, like in the end, I think I've only talked to a couple friends about it who are like my kind of art confidants. And I feel really good about it because it's like, I think it's like a receipt from the Give Me Cred project. It's like a, yeah, it's like the most important byproduct from that project.
Yeah. I was thinking some more as you were talking about the concept or the prospect of your having this real emotional experience, you know, involving mourning, among other things, you know, on film or on video, I should say, and it, you know, and it being archived, you know, on, or available on YouTube, and yet, you know, in this institution, it's kind of nobody talks about it. Presumably, out in the world, which is to say, YouTube, you know, it sits there, you know, it sits there neglected, you know, in one of the infinite number of corners of YouTube. And then I was thinking about this sentiment that Max Haven expressed at one point in one of our conversations about these really profound pieces that he has experienced where it was just like a, you know, a handful of people getting to experience them. And this seems to be the epitome of that. You know, it's like you can have these really profound pieces of work and, you know, a handful of people get them / appreciate them, get to experience them.
Totally. Well, and time is so weird because, like, you know, that was 5 years ago. And, like, I haven't thought about that piece. I haven't used it for anything in so long. And that just that, like, you found it and, like, that it, like, caused this conversation is so amazing. And I think there's a part of art making that is a kind of, like, it's working with the unknown a little bit. And even though it's kind of mundane to think that the unknown might just be like 5 years and then a conversation 5 years after you make something. Like, I do think that there's like a really interesting, when you get out of the market, there's a really interesting possibility for alternative forms of causality. And like, you never know who's going to find these things. I mean, I cannot explain the weird people who have contacted me about my projects and like, asked me to like do stuff for them that are so like deranged and surprising, but that like, you know, maybe I made it for them. I don't know.
Did they feel threatening or creepy or something along those lines in some cases, or just
no
the opposite?
No, like really interesting stuff. Like,
oh good.
Like hedge funds contacting me to be the artist in residence, or like people like someone asking me to like design an anti-capitalist beauty salon for a high school, like just like really weird stuff.
Did you become an artist in residence at a hedge fund?
It never worked out. I should try again. It was in Minnesota. It was like the only feminist hedge fund.
Wow, that would be amazing. Yeah, you should definitely follow up on that. Cassie, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time and for your work.
Yeah, excited to see what happens with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. And we're out.
The podcast and the project.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. Thank you very much again to Cassie Thornton. Hope you guys enjoyed that. I certainly really enjoyed talking to her. And I hope I have her on my other show. And by the way, if you might have noticed, the goodbyes and thank yous that we shared sounded a bit different because they actually came from that other conversation that we had. And that is going to be a bonus episode in which, as we indicated at one point in the conversation, you know, she really loves to talk with people about their work, their projects, whatever they're working on. And so, like I said, I have some things that I wanted to talk to her about based on her experience with housing in particular, because the things I'm interested in are the very same. And so we did end up sort of hashing that through a bit, and I'm going to have to re-listen myself because there was a lot to take in. And so you guys will have a lot to take in as well. So in any case, that will be a bonus episode. And in order to get it, you will either be already on the supporters list of the show, or if you're not there already, this is a great opportunity to remind you this is a listener-supported show. So with a donation of $35 or more, you will get all 10 now of the bonus episodes of the show, a P-word and or Conversation Art Podcast bumper sticker, and My Undying Love, of course. With $25 or more, you can get definitely this one and future ones because you will be added to the list. But, you know, if you go up to that extra 10 bucks, we'll get you to that $35 level or more, and you can get all 10 episodes. Thank you so much to all of you who have been supporting the show on a monthly or annual basis. You know who you are on Patreon, Venmo, and beyond. Thank you so much. And just for logistics, Patreon is a platform where you can pay monthly for as little as $1 a month, though, of course, I love that $10 a month level. It really helps us keep going. And Venmo is great because it doesn't take out fees like PayPal does, but PayPal is fine too. Thank you very much. And good old-fashioned check, if you prefer, that is also an option. So thank you very much in advance if you can support the show financially. I want to tell you actually really soon about some feedback that I've been getting from the series that I did with Max Haven in a second. But first, I wanted to give a big thanks, as always, to producer Andy Davis, who, while on his about third or maybe fourth art residency in a row, took the time to listen to the rough cut of this and helped shape it into the episode that it became. Big thanks to him. I wanted to share with you that I did share recently that I was a little concerned that maybe these episodes with Max were a little too dense, a little too heavy. I wasn't sure how many people were getting into them. I think I've gotten, over the course of the four episodes, particularly after the first one, but definitely as well after the latter three, I have definitely gotten some really great, if not a huge number of people citing their appreciation of that series and how great it's been. And I thank you so much for that. It's great to hear. I just got another email accompanied by a donation from a listener the other day, and I thought what he said kind of really was explicit in the appreciation for the series, also in relation to other art podcasts. So I really appreciated that. I'm just going to read you a paragraph of what he wrote. Just want to let you know how much I enjoyed the series you did with Max Haven. I have been listening to the entire series, and I'm so grateful you gave Max's book and ideas such an extensive series. On the podcast, I heard you worrying a bit about the density and expansiveness of these podcasts, and you said you hadn't received much feedback. Well, here's my feedback. This is a terrific format. Short format interviews and quick hits with artists, curators, and critics are really common, and they're lame. I don't really learn anything from them, but a massive, sprawling conversation like the one you did with Max, you really can't get that anywhere except maybe a master's seminar, and even then, only if the ideas you're interested in hearing about are by, like, Deleuze or Adorno. So yeah, this was awesome. Thank you so much, Mitch, for that fantastic letter. And I want to take this opportunity to both ask you guys, if you have not written it already, if you feel similarly or maybe a little bit differently about the Max series. I would be happy to hear from you as well. And I also want to ask you guys, in advance of my getting into the old news segment that I wrap up the show typically with, aka the Weiss Links, how you are feeling about those, if they feel like, you know, if you guys quit before those even start, or if you generally enjoy and appreciate them. So do let me know that, because, you know, Megan Bickle and I put not an insignificant amount of time into putting those together. So if it's not something that generally I hear from you appreciate, you know, maybe we'll discontinue it. But for now, old news lives on. And of course, this comes courtesy of Jeff Weiss, twice former guest of this show, and put together thanks again to Megan Bickle. Starting with some news that I am almost positive you've heard about, but this is a very concise version of what you may have anecdotally heard about what's been going on at the Whitney. This is courtesy of Art News. Warren B. Kanders resigns from Whitney Board. In a letter to the museum's board, Kanders wrote, "The targeted campaign of attacks against me and my company that has been waged these past several months has threatened to undermine the important work of the Whitney. I joined this board to help the museum prosper. I do not wish to play a role, however inadvertent, in its demise." And just in case you don't know the business that he is in, one of the products that his company produces is tear gas canisters, which were infamously and notoriously used in among many of the confrontations at the border. So, all right, moving on. Pussy Riot performed in Alabama to protest state's new abortion laws. Pussy Riot played a show last night in Birmingham, Alabama, to protest the state's recent passage of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. Activists on both sides of the abortion debate demonstrated outside the 500-person venue, while inside, the Russian punk band, clad in neon baklavas and other masks, gave a sold-out performance. The group debuted its new song, "No More Wire Hangers," in front of a screen that projected phrases like, "Ignorance hurts," and "Against abortion, don't have one." Proceeds from the performance are being donated to Planned Parenthood and the Yellowhammer Fund, an organization that aids Alabama women seeking abortions. That's from ArtNet. This is again from Art News. Culture workers just say no to all unpaid internships. And this is actually a follow-up of a spreadsheet and the salaries that people inserted into that spreadsheet that I talked about a couple of episodes ago. Just over a month ago, we started a Google spreadsheet that invited art workers to add their salaries, job titles, and workplaces, as well as additional information as they saw fit. The data was shaped collaboratively and in real time, and it started with only a handful of our own entries. The spreadsheet has now been clicked on over 30,000 times, has almost 3,000 entries, and is still growing. This document is the product of employees of art organizations and museums of all kinds who came together to break the silence around low wages and workplace exploitation in the cultural sector. It grew because of the work of every single contributor who added in their own details. Some individuals' work is not reflected in the data, though. For various reasons, some felt that they could not make their salaries public, so they shared the spreadsheet and talked with colleagues about it. Asked about what comes next, the answer was, for us, very simple. The summer is high internship season in many fields. Today we are sharing another spreadsheet focused on this endemic form of unpaid work in museums and arts organizations. The most difficult numbers to read on the salary transparency spreadsheet were the zeros entered by people working for free. This is why our next step to ask for another pooling of knowledge from current and recent interns. If the base salary in our field is $0, then it's no wonder that the next step up is not much higher. We know what working for free does to the chances of truly diversifying or addressing equity within any intersection of art and museum labor. And yet many of us still support unpaid internships implicitly and explicitly. Unpaid labor is never truly free. It foists costs onto others, including interns themselves, and ultimately suppresses wages all the way up the pay scale. The elimination of unpaid labor is a necessary first step toward real and lasting change. And again, that's from Art News. And I should say that this did make me cognizant of my own potential complicity in this type of situation. Now, I don't know if I am particularly comparable, the Conversation Art Podcast, to a gallery or certainly a museum or nonprofit type of entity. This is a for-profit show. I do make very, very little income or get very little money in the course of doing this show. You probably know by now that Andy Davis, Sarah Suarez, and Megan Bickle do help out on this show. I have paid them, if at all, modestly, in a little honorarium, basically, that came up at a particular juncture in our arc working together. And this is because, you know, this isn't really a business per se. I mean, just to give you an idea, to maybe be transparent myself, along the lines of this spreadsheet, I am currently earning from the Patreon donations $90 a month. So I am paying $15 a month for the hosting of this site, you know, not to mention, obviously, how much time I invest in this show. So if you would like to weigh in on my not paying my interns, if I don't even really call them interns, I call them producers, you know. It's a sign of respect and collaboration. And, you know, if you would like to make a donation to the show and allocate it specifically to one of the people helping out, I would be more than happy to honor that donation and pledge. All right, I think that's enough moralizing and blabbering on my part. Why don't we end on a fun one, shall we? This is from the notorious Gregorg via Twitter, I believe. I've loved this Katie Nolan fact since it surfaced 3 years ago and two lawsuits ago, because it does not really sound like a disavowal, but an insistence to document the work's history and condition. And now if you click on the tiny URL link that Gregorg supplies, you actually see a print of this fax. And it's from Katie Nolan. And Katie Nolan, if you're not already familiar, is an artist who is notorious for her, shall we say, challenging interactivity with institutions, collectors, and others. And this will give you a taste of that. In the upper right corner of the fax is, in a box she prints in all caps, "This is not an artwork." The fax is addressed to quote-unquote mystery client, and she says at the top, "P.S., I suggest you not take up," and I'm going to emphasize when, in cases she's either underlined or put in quotes certain words, I'm going to underline them with my tone. "P.S., I suggest you not take up one more moment of my time, and the next time around, man up and call the artist yourself." Okay, so again, to mystery client. If the previous owner did work with a so-called conservator, I certainly was not consulted, nor did I approve whatever was done. From now on, the provenance must include the fact that the piece was repaired by a conservator, but the artist wasn't consulted. The conservator's name should be on the provenance accompanying that important fact. As any reputable valuation expert will tell you, the work needs to be depreciated in value because of the repair that hadn't been overseen or agreed to by the artist. So, for example, if you were to gift the work to a museum, the tax deduction should reflect this depreciated amount. You may not produce / reproduce photos to go online or to be printed. I own the photo copyright. And I suppose I own the copyright to this podcast, though if you distribute it, I will be more than happy for you to do so. Thank you guys so much, as always, for listening to this show, for your feedback, for your donations, and for following us on social media at Artist Podcast. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Cassie. I hope you will pony up a little cash to get the bonus episode if you're not already on the list. And I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Be well and ciao for now.